Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to Filmmaking Conversations with Damian Swaby. Listen to conversations with award-winning filmmakers, directors from the golden age of television, and creatives from the indie film community who continue to inspire the next generation of filmmakers. And now, over to your host, Damian Swaby.
Hi, Lisa. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks, Damian. How are you?
I'm doing absolutely fine. I love speaking to great filmmakers, especially great documentary filmmakers who have done work that I completely relate to and I'm interested in. It's great to have you on the podcast today. It really, really is. And I was lucky enough to go online and find some of your work and read about your history. And I really felt that it would be great for you to come on, because a lot of documentary makers want to make passion projects and projects that can help others. And in some ways, maybe more importantly, they want to touch upon things that people around the world might not necessarily know. So watching your work was really, really interesting to me, and it was really, really educational. So I appreciate you being out there and making such brilliant work.
Thanks, Damian. That's very kind of you to say all of that. I hope that my films do touch people and, create dialogue around some of these really important issues that we're all facing.
Good, definitely. And they certainly are. And when I see someone like yourself, I wonder how you got your start and what made you drawn to documentary filmmaking. And I also noticed that you're a part of New Day Films as well, which is a great organization from the lovely stuff I've seen from them. So how exactly did you get your start becoming a documentary filmmaker?
I teach filmmaking at the university level. So, my students learn, to make various kinds of films and learn about camera and editing and sound and all of that stuff at the undergraduate level. But I didn't do any of that as an undergraduate. I studied, the humanities. I was interested in learning about other cultures and languages. And I was really interested in traveling when I was younger. So that was more my focus back then. And I watched a lot of films. I was really interested in watching films. I mean, particularly foreign films, because I was interested in travel and cultures and all of that. So I didn't really begin my filmmaking career until after college. And even then, I was 25 when I went to the American Film Institute, which is a graduate program here in the U.S. It's in Los Angeles. And then I didn't make my first film until my early 30s. So I was a late bloomer, but I was much more interested in the world around me before I ever really picked up a camera. I worked on a lot of people's projects doing editing in my 20s, but I didn't make my own film until my 30s. So I got into it, I got a late start, but I feel like my training was more in all the things that, just learning to become a person in the world,
That's amazing. What makes you so interested in traveling?
Well, you know, I grew up in upstate New York. I wasn't in a major city. I was, the nearest place I could walk to, really one of the only businesses I could walk to from my house was a video store. So I would often walk down to the video store and stand in front of the foreign language section and choose a film. And so I think part of that was just like really, I was just interested in learning, you know. And then, you know, there'd be like foreign exchange students at my high school. And I was always interested in those people and learning about how their world and life is different from mine. I don't know. That's something that's always been interesting to me.
That's brilliant that you're interested in the world around you. And it's apparent because of the stuff you make that you're looking outwards completely rather than necessarily just inwards. So when you had other people's work to edit, what was that experience like and who were you editing for?
Well, I made some great connections at the American Film Institute with other filmmakers. And I worked with some of those fellow AFIers for a while. I married one of them. and we actually, he is the editor. He's the editor of Missing in Brooks County. So we don't usually collaborate, but we collaborated on this project. And I was really fortunate to work with some great filmmakers before I actually made my own film, which is probably also really great training for me. I definitely feel like editing, especially with documentary, like a background in editing is so key, because when you're filming, if you can understand the process of editing, it really informs how you approach the filming process. So I was definitely an editor before I was ever a shooter. And I feel that was probably the best training one could ever have in terms of filming your own documentary. And I shoot all of my own documentaries. In Missing in Brooks County, I co-directed and co-shot with someone else. But in general, I do all of my own filming because I tend to gravitate toward a more intimate style of filmmaking. So I can't even fathom having a crew with me while I'm filming. So, and maybe I'm just a control freak, but I definitely like to shoot my own films.
I would say you're probably not a control freak. That's my guess for sure. But I would say you're incredibly talented to be able to be a self-shooter, because I definitely know from experience, it's no easy thing to wake up in the morning and go and shoot by yourself. Sound, for me, is always a problem as a self-shooter. How would you get over any sound issues you may have to go through as a self-shooter? What kind of advice could you give other documentary filmmakers regarding that?
I mean, I've made my share of mistakes with sound. And I think, you know, every time you make a mistake and a bad mistake, you never make that mistake again. So just being really aware of the sound, it was great on Missing in Brooks County because Jeff and I could, take turns with camera and sound. Sometimes we had two cameras going at the same time, but when we didn't, you know, the other person could be the eyes and ears of what was going on and sort of help the other person who was filming. So that was an incredible experience to share that responsibility with someone else. It's tricky. I just think being aware of the sound as much as possible, like understanding how important sound is, like one, you can't fix bad sound. So you can help it a little bit, but you can't really fix it. So I think just the awareness of it is really important. Taking charge and shutting off AC units and unplugging fridges and shutting off computer monitors whenever possible. And really just like being hyper aware of it, I think is key.
So do you use lav mics usually, or would you use, well, how would you use a boom self-shooting and behind the camera? How do you get over these solutions?
Yeah, I tend to rarely use a boom just because I'm just such a thin, you know, it's such a small crew. It's just normally just me or me and Jeff. Lavs, the onboard mic, the shotgun mic on the camera. You know, there are these Zoom recorders that are pretty inexpensive you can buy. So you can place those on a table or on a desk or, you know, it's depending on the situation and the shoot, it'll be a different setup, but just something that's easy, fast, and good quality. So that's, yeah, we you know, we really didn't buy elaborate sound equipment for Missing in Brooks County. And I tend to use stuff that's not particularly expensive, but that works really well. Zoom recorders are great. And the small ones can act as lav mics too. You can put a lav mic on them and just have them, you know, put it in their pocket. Sometimes I use a more traditional lav. It just depends.
True. I love what you're saying there. That makes a lot of sense. And it's, I know a lot of people will take that on board and move forward in that way regarding audio issues they may have. But the first film I saw from you was Teaching in Arizona. And I was really drawn to it because there are so many different ways to educate people. And sometimes we don't really realize that. And it was an interesting topic for you to go into and to film, especially now I know you've done that as a self-shooter. Tell us a bit about that short documentary you made and why you made it.
Well, I was actually commissioned to make that. There was a, I live in Tucson, Arizona, and my son actually attends public school here. So it is something that's very important to me. I mean, regardless of my son, I think education is really important. And I've made a number of films about education over the years. But this film was a commission work, and I collaborated with a local organization, but they kind of gave me, you know, free range, which is great. And I, with them, I found three teachers who were, you know, in different stages of their teaching career. But really, the goal was to just show how intense it is to be a teacher these days in America and probably everywhere. The expectations, the you know, the behind the scenes that parents and other people don't see that teachers are doing, that teachers are struggling with. We do have a crisis here in Arizona. There's a teaching shortage. The amount of money given to for education in this state is much lower than in most of the rest of the states. And this film is really to show this crisis, and sort of the root of the crisis is really just in this, the lack of money and resources for teachers. And if you don't have well-supported teachers and well, you know, appreciated teachers, I mean, you don't have an education system because it's all about the teachers. So we focused on three, you know, different teachers who were more or less successful at what they were doing and really tried to demonstrate all that they're dealing with. And it was, I mean, it was an education for me. I got to spend a lot of time in these various classrooms. I mean, you know, even if you have a child in school, you don't get to spend a lot of time in the classroom. So you don't get to really experience. And then outside of the classroom, spending time with the teachers at home or after school was a real education for me. So I think, you know, people who have seen, many, many people have seen this film in Arizona. And I think people who have seen it have been really surprised at the just this crazy disconnect between how important this profession is and how little they are paid. And it doesn't quite make sense if, you know, if we want to raise kids and have a society filled with educated and successful people. So that's why we made the film. And it was a real pleasure to spend time with these teachers and to dig into their stories and share this story with Arizona and beyond.
Have you thought of upgrading your cinematography game? Would you like to have an ASC cinematographer mentor you for free? Join veteran cinematographer Suki Medenzovic, ASC, Disney, Pixar, FX Networks, Netflix, American Horror Story, as he teaches you how to create beautiful images using three lighting techniques he has mastered on film sets over his 30-plus years in the film industry. Each technique uses basic, low-cost lighting equipment so that anyone can achieve beautiful visuals no matter your project's budget. If you want to take your cinematography to the next level, visit filmmakingconversations.com to sign up for instant access.
So when you say you were commissioned to make this film, was it an issue you went to get funding, or did someone say, this is a bad situation and we're putting out an offer for people to be commissioned to make the story, to make the film, sorry?
Yeah, the latter. So there was an organization who wanted to make a film about this, and they found me. And in fact, they had seen my film Schools Out, which is about a forest kindergarten in Switzerland. And so that's why they reached out to me. And I actually didn't really have a whole lot of time at that time to work on it. And I said no initially. And then I kind of thought about it and I was like, you know, this is a topic that I'm really interested in and is really important to me. And I just kind of made time to do it. But yeah, this wasn't something that I was thinking about doing, but I think it was an obvious match for me because I had recently made another film about education. So they saw that and reached out to me.
Congratulations. And the people involved in that film, the teachers and the organization themselves, what type of feedback did you get from them when they saw the finished film?
Yeah, that's always an interesting moment when you share the film with the participants in the film and you're sort of like holding your breath and hoping that they're going to be good with it and that they're going to be proud and happy they participated. I have those moments every time I make a film. So it was really, really nice to share the film with the teachers. They were thrilled and really felt like I captured the essence of their stories and felt really proud to be part of the project. So that was wonderful. And, you know, I think it's kind of, it was an acknowledgement to them, you know, of, you know, something they already knew, which was how hard they work and how little they're valued. And I think they felt like I really captured that story. And they felt like, you know, everyone needs to see this.
Oh, amazing. I'm really happy for you that happened, because involving such a topic, some people may have a different view. Sometimes people can be negative or they don't understand what's happened. So I'm really happy that you got that type of feedback. And I always find feedback like that is empowering for the next project you go on to. You're happy going into new things when you receive those type of kind words. So the biggest thing I've seen from you, and I say biggest meaning the length of time in terms of documentaries you've made, sorry, is Missing in Brooks County. From what I'm aware of, premiered in the fall of 2020. And what a documentary. I mean, I believe it was worth every one of the 11 awards it won. And probably more, because I know it done really well in the festival circuit. So can you tell us what the film's about and then maybe afterwards why you actually wanted to make it?
Well, I live in the Southwest. I live in Arizona, obviously. And Jeff Bemis, who is the co-director, who actually lives in Connecticut, and I know him from my time when I lived there, reached out to me about a story that he had heard about, and it was somewhat related to the story of Missing in Brooks County. And we, you know, talked about collaborating on a project together, and we went to Texas. And this woman that we had initially thought we might want to make a film about, she brought us to Brooks County. So initially we thought we were making a film about a forensic scientist, who is actually not in the final film, but she brought us to Brooks County. And I think within hours of being in Brooks County, our whole idea of what this film was going to be completely shifted. We thought we were making like a short film about a forensic scientist. And we kind of, over the course of, you know, hours even, we, you know, met people and saw things that were, it was almost surreal and sort of in a way like unrecognizable to us as our country, what's going on there. So, I mean, basically what's going on there is there's an interior checkpoint. So it's the checkpoint is about 70 miles north of the US-Mexico border. And it's in essence really a second border. This checkpoint forces migrants to circumvent it and to walk for days on these private ranches where there's no water, you know, in the Texas heat in the summer, and many go missing and are never heard from again. And so we, you know, learned more about what was going on. How did it come to be that this checkpoint was, you know, is here? It's not on the border. It's very far from the border. Why is it there? And what we learned was that in the early 90s, the Clinton administration put into effect prevention through deterrence, which is a strategy to, to rather than migrants being able to come through the cities like San Diego and El Paso and the sort of more obvious points of entry, those points of entry were blocked off through law, you know, border patrol, law enforcement. And then the migrants are forced to come through much more desolate and, you know, dangerous terrain. And then these checkpoints exist, which, you know, create them to, you know, sort of have these long walks through the desert without water, you know, in a very dangerous environment, you know, wild animals. So, you know, this strategy was meant to deter migrants from coming. But of course, we know that that didn't work and people continued to come because their circumstances for leaving their home country didn't go away and people are forced to migrate. So, you know, since that time, you know, thousands and thousands of people have died doing this journey, this dangerous journey, whether it's in Arizona or now Texas is sort of the hot place to cross, partly because so many people are coming from Central America and it's geographically, it's more obvious to come through Texas from Central America. And so the film is essentially about two families that come to Brooks County looking for their missing loved ones. There are other points of view and stories in the film, but the two main stories of the film are families that last heard from their loved ones when they were in Brooks County. So that's the film that we made. It was, you know, we made it over the course of 5 years and we just kept going back to Brooks County and digging deeper and deeper into the story. And we would go every few months and scrape together the money for travel and eventually got bigger film grants and executive producers who believed in the story and were deeply affected by this crisis and story. So, you know, it was a long journey making this film, and it was certainly not the film we set out to make in January of 2015, but it's the film that we ended up with.
Excellent, and it's an excellent film. And I'm not sure if casting is the right word for the documentary, so I don't mean it in a funny way when I say casting for the film, but some of the people in the film I just found extraordinary. I couldn't believe the amount of work Eddie puts in to really trying to help people. And he obviously is very different than Michael Vickers, I think I'm right by saying, who doesn't like the idea of these people, from what I could see, maybe even being alive, let alone trying to drink water. Which I kind of felt was quite mean. A bit of a spoiler alert here for anyone who hasn't seen the film is that when they are given a chance to drink water in certain situations, some people are not happy about that. And sometimes they write mean things where they're able to get water. And the difference of opinion in many of the people in this documentary is what really made it strong for me. And you gave them the time to speak and really showcase what they're about and who they are. So it's not completely one-sided. It's not completely a gotcha type moment in documentary. It's a fair documented example of a situation that's happening in the world. So the people that you've got in this documentary, how did you get them in the documentary, and what were they like off camera as well?
I mean, pretty much everyone was themselves in the documentary. But in terms of how we gained access to all of these different stories, I think just persistence and, you know, building relationships. I mean, the nice thing about Brooks County is it's a really small place. So, you know, it's much easier to become the fabric of something, even though you're not living there, where we made so many trips there, and we really got to know a lot of people and, you know, create relationships and explain what we're doing to people, because it was really hard for them to understand what we were doing. They were used to reporters coming for like a few hours or a day and getting the story and leaving. And we just kept showing up like over and over again. Every few months, it was like, oh my God, you guys again. And, you know, everywhere we go, and everyone kind of recognized us after a while. And so I think, you know, one thing that we believe in terms of, for example, Mike Vickers, is that, you know, he really believes what he believes, you know, and so he wants to tell his story. He's not hiding from it. And so it's interesting. There were definitely a lot of challenges in making this film. And we, you know, one of the things, you know, we asked if we could go on an operation within one of these sort of vigilante operations with the Texas Border Volunteers, which is this group that he started. It's a vigilante group that they go out once a month and look for migrants. And we asked him probably for like 3 years, you know, can we go out on an operation with you? Can we go out on an operation? And he kept saying, okay, well, I have to talk to the board. And so every time we asked him, he would say that. And we kind of felt like, okay, this is never happening. And then one day we asked him again and he said, yes. So I don't know what changed. You know, that took some time and persistence, but really I feel like the biggest challenges in making this film, one, this is a boring answer, but I have to say it, money, you know, fundraising, that's always a challenge with documentary. So I feel like I've got to be honest and say that, you know, having the funds to make a film, you know, figuring that out is always challenging. But the second thing is, you know, this is such a, you know, deeply emotional and difficult story to live with. And, you know, to be thinking about this for 5, 6 now, maybe at this point, it's almost 7 years that, you know, we've been working in this. And it's, you know, it's difficult. It's difficult, obviously, for the families, and it's difficult for all the people that are in Brooks County picking up the pieces of this mass disaster. But, you know, as a sort of secondary person, you know, it's hard for me too, to, you know, get to know the Romans, the main family in our film, get to know what they're going through and spend time with them and, you know, really see firsthand how this is affecting, you know, a beautiful family who loved their son, brother. And it's, you know, it's difficult stuff to live with. So I would say like that's maybe even harder than the actual physically, like figuring out how do I get access to this and that, and you know, all of the things you need to figure out in the editing of a film too, like how does it all come together? You know, some of those things are really challenging. But you know, the emotional stuff is really, really probably the most difficult of everything, because you know, you want to feel, I'm American, you know, I want to feel like this is a good country, but it's really difficult to feel proud and happy to be American when you see something like this. It's really, really difficult.
You're holding the camera a lot of the time for this film, as well as your other camera operator. And emotionally, the story is strong, and I can see how it'd be upsetting to be filming something like that very often. So the one of the first shots in the film, another somewhat spoiler alert, is completely shocking when a body is found in a state that I've never seen before. How do you cope filming extreme situations like that? And did you know at all what you was about to see?
Well, Jeff actually filmed that, thankfully. I had, you know, we were using two cameras for a lot of those type of scenes in the film. And I didn't shoot that one in particular because I just was, it really was very upsetting. And I was not in an emotional state to do that at that moment. But some of the other scenes where we find remains, we did two cameras. Like I would be wide, Jeff would be close. We would, you know, talk about how we're going to film it. And the interesting thing is in that moment, you know, camera's very technical, focus, exposure. You're thinking about very, very technical things, and it's easy to help. It helps you kind of remove yourself from the emotional aspect of what you're filming, and you're just trying to cover it well and get what you need to. And then it's afterwards, when you're away from the situation and by yourself, that you really process what you've seen. So I think in the moment, it's a little bit easier because you can just really focus on the technical stuff and you don't have to focus on what you're really seeing. And then it's really later on, especially in the plane rides back to Arizona from Texas, thinking about what we've seen, what we've experienced. That was more of when I was really processing it. So it's kind of interesting. I think it's almost like, you know, my brain is protecting me by, like, you know, having me focus on these very like detailed kinds of like technical issues, or you know, like the camera stuff, so I don't have to really feel anything, and I can just kind of. But that day that we found that person unexpectedly, I had had enough at that point, because that actually came later in the filming, even though it comes very early in the film. It came later in the filming, and it's a process you go through with something like this. Like at first you're very like curious to learn more about a situation, and then you're, you know, you become troubled by it more and more, and then you just become really angry. You know, you become angry that this is happening and that no one cares. No one seems to be doing anything, even though this has been going on for decades now. And you know, the lawmakers in Washington know this is happening. This is no secret. It's just, you know, the public in general here in the U.S. do not really know what's going on. And there are a lot of reasons for that. But
sorry, what do you think some of the reasons are the public don't know about it?
Well, one of the reasons is that Border Patrol is, they report numbers every year of remains that they find, and their numbers are really low because they only report the numbers where they are actually at the recovery. And they are not at every recovery. So that's part of it. But also there's so many people that are missing that are never found. And so if only one in five people that go missing are found, then those numbers are, you know, one fifth of the deaths that we've had along the border. And I feel like if the public knew the numbers we're talking about, like we're talking about potentially 50,000, maybe more people that have died since the early 90s crossing the border. If people understood those numbers, they would be alarmed. But right now, you know, you just get the numbers that Border Patrol are reporting. And it's, you know, it's a story that occasionally makes it into the mainstream media, but it's not for whatever. It's a quiet crisis. It's not like a plane crashing or, you know, it's slowly happening every single day along the border for decades. So it's quiet. It's not something that the public really knows about.
I see what you mean. And the emotional toll that must have taken on you, I completely understand how at the end, especially, you're kind of tired of seeing things, and it can be quite sickening. And I often worried about Alex Jara, the patrol agent. He must have gone through so much, walking around, finding things and being in situations like that. How did he cope throughout the filming? Because I often wondered, is that someone who often cries in silence?
Yeah, I mean, Alex Jara has a family, you know, he has children, you know, he can, like anyone, you know, everyone in the film is dealing with this crisis in one way or another, whether it's an activist, whether it's a vigilante rancher, whether it's a Border Patrol agent, a family member, everyone is having to pick up the pieces and deal with this in their own way. And, you know, Alex Jara also, you can just see on his face that he's seen a lot, and it's, you know, it's haunting. It's haunting. I can say for myself, he has seen a lot more than I have, for sure. And I can say for me, it's haunting to see some of these things, and to, you know, it doesn't go away. You don't forget about these images. And that's part of why we didn't look away in the film. Like, we didn't shy away from showing some of the harder images to see, because we feel like people really have to see what's going on.
They really do. And now the film's out, it's premiered. What are your hopes for this film, and where exactly do you want it to go even further?
Well, you know, we've done the festival circuit. We had a limited theatrical release. The film will be on PBS in January, and also is currently streaming on all the usual platforms. So we want the public to see it. But aside from that, we are very much immersed in an impact campaign. We have actually shown leaders of Border Patrol the film. We had a screening about a month ago with a whole slew of Border Patrol leaders around the country. We are hoped to have a congressional screening in the winter, and really explain to our elected officials, you know, what is going on, and kind of give them this real inside intimate look at this crisis, because they don't live at the border. They live in Washington, D.C. They don't see firsthand what's going on. And we're really hoping to start to have a conversation about some serious change about our policies, our border policies.
I completely understand that. And I'm glad you're doing it. You're not just being creative as a documentary maker, you're making work that matters and potentially can force change. And we really, really need that in the world, where film can educate, inform, and make important changes that the world needs. So Lisa, thank you so much for coming on. I really, really appreciate it, and you taking and giving me some of your time so we can discuss some of your brilliant work.
Thanks, Damien. Thanks so much for inviting me onto your show. And I really appreciate it. And, you know, part of the process of getting the film out into the world is talking with people like you, and really, you know, trying to get as many people to watch this film and understand what's going on here. That's sort of the ultimate goal for us. So thank you so much for inviting me.
If you enjoyed listening to this episode, please do hit the subscribe button or leave a review on iTunes.